Chapter 5. I got out the lump of chalk I always keep in my duster's pocket, and the circular plastic dome compass that rides a strip of Velcro on my dashboard, then squatted down, my voluminous coat spreading out over my legs and ankles. I drew a rough circle on the asphalt around me with the chalk. The markings were bright against the dark surface and almost glowed beneath the light of the nearly full moon. I added an effort of will, a tiny investment of energy, to close the circle, and immediately felt the ambient magic in the air around me crowd inward, trapped within the confines of the design. The hairs at the nape of my neck prickled and stood on end. I shivered and took the shard of glass with its swiftly drying bloodstain and laid it down in a circle between the toes of my boots. I began a low little chant of nonsense syllables, relaxing, focusing my mind on the effect I wanted. In terri sarium, I murmured, and touched the plastic dome of the compass to the damp blood. Energy rushed out of me, swirled within the focusing confines of the circle I had drawn, and then rushed downward into the compass with a visible shimmer of silver, dust-like motes. The compass needle shuddered, spun wildly, and then swung to the bloodstain on the dome like a hound picking up a scent. Then it whirled about and pointed to the southeast, whipping around the circle to hover steadily in that direction. I grinned in anticipation and smudged the chalk with my boot, releasing the remaining stray energy back into the air, and took up the compass and returned it to the blue beetle. The problem with this particular spell was that the compass needle would point unerringly at whoever the blood had come from until the sun rose the next morning and disrupted the simple magical energies I had used to make the spell. But it didn't point out the swiftest way to get to the target, only the direct direction in which he, she, or it lay. Traffic in Chicago isn't ever what any sane person would call friendly or simple. But I had lived there for a while and learned to survive. I drove past Cook County Hospital, a virtual city of its own inside Chicago, down past Douglas Park, and then turned south to Kedzie. The compass needle slowly aligned to point hard to the east, and I traveled south, and I wound up turning east on 55th toward the University of Chicago in Lake Michigan. It wasn't exactly a good part of town. In fact, as far as neighborhoods go in Chicago, it was pretty bad. There was a high crime rate, and a lot of buildings were run down, abandoned, or infrequently used. Streetlights were out in a lot of places, so when night closed in, it was darker than most areas. It's always been the favorite haunt for some of the darker things that come crawling out of the never-never for a night on the town. Trolls lurked about like muggers some nights, and any new vampire that came through the city always ended up in this neighborhood, or one like it, searching for prey until he could make contact with Bianca or one of the lesser vampire figures of the city. I pulled over as the compass swung to point at what looked like an abandoned department store, and I killed the engine. The faithful beetle rattled to a grateful halt. I got the map of the city out of the glove box and squinted at it for a moment. Washington Park and Burnham Park, where four of last month's deaths had been taking place, were less than a mile away on either side of me. I felt a little shiver run through me. It sure as hell looked like the place to find Murphy's Lobo Killer. I got out of the car. I kept the blasting rod in my right hand, the dashboard compass in my left. My shield bracelet dangled from my wrist. My gun was in the left pocket of my duster, within easy reach. Took a moment to take a deep breath, to clear my mind, and to clarify what I wanted to do. I wasn't there to bring the killer down, whoever he was. I was just locating him for Murphy. Murphy could put the guy under surveillance and nail him the next time he tried to move. Even if I did capture him, Murphy couldn't exactly bring him up on charges based on the word of a professional wizard. Municipal judges would love having a cop appear before them and start spouting crazy talk like that. I spun my blasting rod around in my fingers, grinned, and started forward. That was all right. I didn't need the justice system to recognize my power to be able to use it. There were boards over the front windows of the once department store. I tested each one as I went past and found that one swung in easily. I stopped and examined it carefully, wary of any alarms that might be attached to it, such as the string tied across the bottom, lined with little jingle bells. If I had pushed the wooden sheath any further inward, I would have set it to jangling. Instead, I slipped the string off the head of one of the nails that hung by, lowered the bells carefully, and slipped inside the dim confines of the abandoned store. It was a skeletal place. There were still the bones of shelves forming long aisles, but now barren of merchandise. Empty fluorescent light fixtures dangled in forlorn rows from the ceiling, and the powdered glass of shattered tubular bulbs dusted the floor beneath them. Light seeped in from the street, mostly moonlight, but more light came in from the back of the store. I checked my blood-stained compass. The needle was pointing firmly toward the light. I closed my eyes and listened. A skill that isn't hard to pick up, but that most people don't know how to do anymore. I heard voices, at least a pair of them, talking in hushed, urgent tones. I crept toward the back of the store, using the barren shelves to keep myself from being seen. Then I held my breath and peeked up over the top of the last row of shelves. Gathering around an old Coleman lantern were several people, all young, of various shapes and sizes and both genders. They were dressed in all shades of black, and most wore jackets and bracelets and collars of dark leather. Some had earrings, nose rings. One had a tattoo showing on his throat. If they had been tall, muscular folk, they would have looked intimidating, but they weren't. They were like college students, or younger, still some with acne or too oily hair, beards that wouldn't grow all the way in, and the thinness of youth. They looked awkward and out of place. Four or five of them were gathered behind and around a stout young man less than 5.5 feet tall. He had thick glasses and pudgy fingers and would have looked more at home with a pocket protector than with the spiked leather gloves on his fingers. He stood with his hands on his hips, glaring up at the rail-thin blonde girl, at least a head taller than he was, the lines of her willowy body all awkward, her long, sad face set in an expression of anger. Her hair fell about her face and head in a ragged mane, but her eyes sparkled with contained wrath. Another 5 or 6 of the young people were gathered behind her, and everyone seemed tense. "And I'm telling you," the young man snarled in a muted voice, "that we should be out there right now. We can't allow ourselves to rest until we've found them all and torn them apart." There was a murmur of agreement from the people beside him. "I swear, Billy," the blonde said, "you are such a testosterone-laden idiot. If we were out there right now, they might catch on to us." "Use your head, Georgia," Billy snapped back. "You think they haven't figured it out by now? They could take all of us out right this minute if they hit us." "They haven't," Georgia pointed out. "She told us not to move again tonight, and I'm not moving. And if you try it, so help me, I'm going to tie your ankles to your ears." Billy growled, actually growled, though it sounded posed and forced, and stepped forward. "You think you can handle me, bitch?" he said. "Bring it on." George's eyes narrowed. "I didn't sign on to this wolf thing to fight hapless losers like you, Billy. Don't make me start now." She glared at the young people standing behind Billy. "You know what she told us. Are you going to start going up against her word?" "Listen, alphas," Billy said, turning to look at those behind him and then at those backing his opponent. "I've led you for all this time. I've done what I've promised to do. Are you going to stop trusting me?" I peered at the discussion and then lowered my head again, back into the shadows. Holy, I was a teenage werewolf Batman. I checked my compass and it pointed firmly at the lit room, the group gathered around the lantern. Were these the killers? They looked more like a group of computer nerds geared up for leather night. Well, this was a start, at least. I could clear out now and let Murphy know what I'd seen. I need to check around the building outside first, see if any of the group had any cars parked nearby to be able to give Murphy the license plate numbers. Hell, we weren't far from the university. Maybe some of them would have parking passes. "What is the meaning of this?" came a clear, strident woman's voice. I craned my neck up to the edge of the shelf again. A dark-complected woman, as tall as the long-faced blonde but older, solid, with muscle, and moving with an animal surety, had come into the room from a back door. Her brown hair was peppered gray, and it took me only a second to recognize the woman from the car in the parking lot outside of McAnally's. My heart started to pound a little more quickly with excitement. She had been following Murphy and me after all. She glared at the two groups of young people, her eyes almost an eerie shade of amber that could barely be construed as brown. "Have I taught you no better?" the woman demanded. Billy and Georgia were looking down at the floor uncomfortably,